searching for news and information that supported my worldview at the time, something corporate mainstream media never offered me and never will. KPFK offers a wide range of programming, a little something for everybody. But for me, one of the crown jewels of KPFK has to be Eric Mann's Voices from the Frontlines. No corporate neoliberal BS here, just intelligent and informative conversation about topics and issues facing our city, our country, and the world. So to keep this type of programming on the air, I encourage everyone listening to take the time to donate and donate generously to this great radio station to keep independent media alive. You can donate online at kpfk.org or by calling 818-985-KPFK. Thank you, KPFK, for everything you do.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego County, and 99.5 Ridgecrest and China Lake, and streaming online at kpfk.org. Stay with us for alternative radio. Rootwork will return next week.
And I'm going to tell you what I fear if we don't get a handle on inequality. From the experience of the past, from what happened in 18th century France, from what's happened again and again and around the world, if we don't get a handle on inequality, if we don't recognize that it is destroying our health, destroying our democracy, destroying our freedoms, our heirs are going to sit down in high school one of these days and they are going to open their 10th grade history book. And they're going to read a chapter that begins with the words, "The United States of America was."
That's David K. Johnston, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features David K. Johnston on the societal impact of inequality. The United States has the dubious distinction of being the most unequal of all developed countries. The gaps between rich and poor have not been seen since the Gilded Age over a century ago. The 0.1% is loaded with stocks, bonds, hedge funds, cash, and property. The respected business journalist Martin Wolf writes, "An out-of-control financial sector is eating out the modern market economy from inside, just as the larva of the spider wasp eats out the host in which it has been laid. Inequality is corroding democracy. While the upper crust has been lining their pockets, the working class, if they even have a job, has been pauperized. Food and rent take up much of their paltry take-home pay. Tens of millions are dependent on food stamps. The homeless population continues to grow. How long can this continue?" Our guest today is David K. Johnston, a former reporter for the New York Times who won the Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of tax policy. He's the author of many books, including Perfectly Legal, The Fine Print, Free Lunch, and Divided. He spoke in Seattle. And now, David K. Johnston.
Inequality. John Adams, the second president of the United States, wrote about his fear that America would eventually produce a business aristocracy, and it would persuade those people who had no property. They weren't yeoman farmers. They weren't workers who owned their tools. They were wage earners, pure wage earners, that the business aristocracy would persuade these pure wage earners that what was in the interests of the business aristocrats was what the country needed. And Adams feared that that would be the end of our liberties and the end of our country. The founders thought a lot about inequality, and they were the richest people in the society. They wanted a nation of yeoman farmers. Madison, shortly before his death, sat down and calculated the likely future population of the U.S. to 1930, and he was pretty close. And he recognized that there wasn't enough land, at least as we understood the size of the country to be in 1824, for everyone to be a yeoman farmer. But he wrote that if we gave everyone a stake in business, in shares of business, so that everyone had capital, that we would live in a society that could solve this problem because there was no limit to the wealth that could be divided up and shared among people who all own stakes in business. Well, today we live in a country in which the bottom 60% of Americans, it's more than 150 million people, they basically don't have any assets. They don't have any assets. The concentration of assets isn't even in the top 1%. Because my wife also works, I'm a 1%er. It takes about $360,000 a year to be a 1%er. You can have a journalist married to an executive. You can have a homicide cop married to a doctor, and you've got a 1%er. That's not the group that's really important. It's the top 10th of 1% and 100th of 1%, and then it's the people above them who are so wealthy that they don't show up in the official government statistics because they have no income. At least not the way Congress measures income. They own private jets, big yachts, sports teams. But as far as government is concerned, they have little to no income. And let me use Warren Buffett as an example. A number of years ago, predicted that Warren Buffett's tax rate, what his tax rate was, what his total federal tax burden for both payroll taxes, like Social Security and Medicare, and income taxes would be. And then he revealed the figure. And immediately one of the right-wing conservatives wrote a piece saying, I was wrong. I missed by 1/10 of a percentage point. Warren Buffett, in doing this, revealed that his income that year was $64 million. Now, his Berkshire Hathaway stock, a company that he's never sold a share of and that pays no dividends, that year was worth $64 billion. So if you believe Warren Buffett's real income was $64 million, the Oracle of Omaha is the worst investor in American history because his return is 0.1%. That's what $64 million is on $64 billion. But he also revealed that he paid $16 million of interest that year, which was tax deductible. Now, if you own a house, you can deduct the interest on a $1 million mortgage and maybe a $100,000 home equity line. How do you get $64 million? Well, it's because Warren Buffett borrows money against his wealth in Berkshire Hathaway, that's not income, and uses it to buy other investments. And he's a man who believes if you buy a stock, unless something goes wrong, you realize you made a mistake, you should never sell it. You hold it forever. So he has what I call incidental income. Wouldn't it be nice to have incidental income of $64 million? And if you look at the interest rate tables, you realize that that suggests his borrowings were somewhere between as much as 50 times that much money that he deducted, and depending on the rate he paid, perhaps 10 times. My auguring is more for the 50 than for the 10. Very wealthy people borrow against their assets, and right now they pay less than 2% interest. And why would anybody pay 20% interest, the lowest government rate, when they can pay 2% to their banker? And so they get wealthier and wealthier and wealthier, spending money they borrow against untaxed assets. Now, contrast that with your average worker. Government doesn't trust, the Congress does not trust you. And by the way, remember that when we come to taxes, it's Congress that makes the rules. Congress does not trust you. Congress says that your taxes will be taken out of your paycheck before you get paid. And your employer or your pension fund or your IRA company, they will report to the government how much money you got so they can check it. But if you're a business owner, and I've been a business owner, if you're a landlord, I've been a landlord, if you're an investor until very recently when some of the rules changed, Congress says, oh, we trust you. You just tell us what you think you made. And if we think there's a problem, we'll audit you. So what is it that we've seen going on in the IRS since the late 1980s? Audits have been going like this. Money's been going like this. If there's no policing, if no one questions your tax return, you get to keep the money. That's the system. It's a system of what's called voluntary compliance. You self-assess, and if you lie and cheat and steal and nobody catches you, you get a free walk. And by the way, the auditors who do big companies, the very biggest companies in America, well, first of all, they're told, oh, Don't look at hedge funds and don't look at private equity funds because they're not taxed directly, so we don't audit them. But if you're a big regular corporation, what the law calls a C corporation, the ones you buy stock in, the ones you hear about in the news every day, the auditors who pursue those biggest companies, the maximum they can earn is just about $150,000 a year. It's a little bit more this year, but not much. $150,000 a year. And how much do they bring in? $19 million a year each. And you know what we've been doing to those auditors? We've been getting rid of them because we can't afford them. They're too expensive. Next time you hear a politician say, government should be run like a business, ask him, well, what business fires salespeople who bring in $19 million of revenue for $150,000 of pay? Nobody in their right mind does that, but people who want to make sure that the very richest people in America do better, they do that. Now, if you listen to the political rhetoric in this country about this, I would say we essentially have two high-level, widely discussed in the media theories. The first theory is the Democrats. They don't know what to do. They really don't know what to do. That sort of, we don't like this inequality, but they really don't have a plan. You got to hand it to the Republicans. The Republicans have both a description of our problem and they have a solution. And if you listen carefully, what I'm going to do, I'm going to put in my words what they say. But if you listen carefully, you will see the truth of what I'm about to tell you. The Republicans have told us again and again and again that the problem in this country is that the job creators, that the wealthy, don't have nearly enough. And the way to get them that money that they need in order to create jobs and make the economy work is to take it from the sick, the disabled, the poor, the elderly, and children in school. That's their plan. And if that sounds outrageous to you, well, crawl across America. If you walk into a big box retail store, if you walk into any store in some shopping malls, the sales tax that you pay gets rung up on the cash register. It doesn't go to the government. It's kept by the store because your tax dollars build these stores. New steel mill, new factory, new Boeing auto air plant, new BMW auto plant. Those are all being built with your tax dollars. No wonder corporate profits are so high. In 20 states, roughly 3,000 American companies, and all of them are big companies, and when I say American, I mean they operate in America, have made deals with the state government that let them keep the income taxes withheld from their workers' paychecks. We literally have people paying taxes to their boss. General Electric, Deutsche Bank, Ford, Mitsubishi, Continental Tire in Germany, Rupert Murdoch's Dow Jones News Service. They all have these deals to pocket the taxes withheld from their workers' paychecks. And as best I can tell, only one company in all of America has ever told any of its workers it has this deal, and that's General Electric in Ohio. I mean, what do you think? How many of you want to pay taxes to your boss? Well, guess what? Nobody knows about it because the law doesn't require workers to be told. And the state says if the taxes are withheld, you, the worker, are off the hook. You paid your taxes. Our laws and regulations are filled with these kinds of rules that take from the many and redistribute to the few. And here's what's the result of that. A bunch of results I'm going to give you. Since 1998, the median wage, half of workers make more, half make less, has essentially been unchanged since 1998. Gone up a little and gone down a little, but it's been stuck at the same level, a little over $500 a week. There are about 150 million people in America with a job. A third of them make less than $15,000, and the average income of that third is $6,000 a year. Now, most of those people are students, retirees who work part-time, homemakers who work part-time. But nonetheless, think about that. One out of three jobs, average annual income, $6,000. Half of workers, less than $520 a week. That's $27,000 a year. Three quarters of workers, less than $50,000 a year. About 75% of workers, less than $80,000 a year. 99% of workers, less than $200,000 a year. And if you're a woman who makes over $200,000 a year, you're in the top half of 1% because very few women are paid a salary of over $200,000 a year. And at the bottom, things are really awful in this country. In 1966, I was a minimum wage worker. I was married. I had the first of my eight children. I had four jobs. I worked 80 hours a week, and I was a senior in high school. I managed to pay the rent on an incredibly crummy place to live and feed the family and put enough gas in the car to go to work. And I know that many days I didn't have a dime in my pocket. If I got in a flat tire or something, I couldn't have even made a phone call to rescue myself. Today, the minimum wage in this country is two-thirds of what it was when I was a minimum wage worker. To earn as much money as I did to just get by, I would have had to work, therefore, not 80 hours a week, but 104 hours a week, and a week has 168 hours in it. It's physically impossible to do it. And we are seeing all across this country, people who are in desperate straits. When I spoke Thursday night, there was a pediatrician who told the story of a mother who seemed to know nothing about the health status of her child. And he was just appalled, and he was getting angry at this mother until he found out that she was a minimum wage fast food worker, and the husband and the wife basically both worked 80 hours a week and traded off in the night on the child, and they had no time to know any of this. And then he said, I turned from anger to sympathy. And that's what we need to do. We need to turn to sympathy. We need to remember what Adam Smith said. Adam Smith, the man who figured out market economics. The disposition to admire and almost to worship the rich and the powerful, and to despise, or at least neglect, persons of poor and mean condition is the great and most universal cause of the corruption of our moral sentiments. We live in a society in which we measure people not by the content of their character, as Martin Luther King said he wished of his children, not the color of their skin, but the content of their character. We measure people in this society by the presumed content of their wallets. And that takes me to another quote from the past, from Plutarch, the Greco-Roman historian. More than 2,000 years ago, he told us, an imbalance between rich and poor is the oldest and most fatal ailment of all republics. Inequality kills. Today in America, 47 babies will die who would be alive if we had the infant mortality rate of Sweden or Norway. If we had the infant mortality rate of Cuba, 15 babies would not die. Think about that. Think about all the politicians who tell you, America's number one, America's first, we're the greatest. No, we're not. And in my travels around the world, in China and Singapore and in Europe and in South America, one of the things I'm struck by is the number of people who just laugh at us. Oh yeah, you're from that country where people who run for president think dinosaurs and human beings played together. Inequality is tearing us apart. And it is vastly larger than we appreciate, because most of the people who cover these issues and write about them as journalists, they're perfectly well-intended. They don't mean to do anything bad, but they're innumerate. They don't understand numbers. They know how to tell stories. And when people tell you, oh, the media in the tank for Obama, or they're in the tank for George W. Bush, no, they're not. They just want good stories. That's what journalists want. So here's an example of one of the kinds of facts that I think, and if I were still at the New York Times, I would have fought to have on the front page, but that I'm the only person who's reported. In 2012, the average income of the bottom 90% of Americans reported on tax returns was just below where it was in 1966, back when I was a minimum wage worker in high school with a family support. So negative numbers create lots of problems. Let me step back 1 year to 2011. That's 45 years after 1966. That's an entire career. If you graduated from high school, you probably retired by that period of time. Well, Americans in the bottom 90% averaged $59 more income after 45 years. And you think you'd notice $5 more a month in your paycheck? So let's take that $59 and count it as 1 inch. Make a graphic. We're going to publish a graphic here. 1 inch. So how do the top 1% do? Top 1% starts at about $1,000 a day, $360,000 a year. Well, their graphic next to this one will come up here from this podium. It's going to run up here. It's going to run over my head. It's going to go through the ceiling. It's going to go through the top of this building. It's going to be over 160 feet. How about the top tenth of 1%? One in 1,000 households. The top tenth of 1%, I'll come back to them in just a second. Their income starts at about $2 million a year. Their line, over 880 feet. And what about the plutocrats, the oligarchs, the people who can get a politician on speed dial, any politician on speed dial? The 1% of the 1%, the 31,000 best-off Americans. 5 miles. 1 inch to 5 miles. Now, if market economics were producing this, and that's what you're told every day if you pay attention to the news, then here's what that would mean. Well, either the 90%, they're all drinking and smoking dope and going to the beach and watching Oprah, and they're not going to work. And the 1% of the 1%, they have invented the most incredible products you've ever heard of. Tea, Earl Grey, hot, and the machine produces it. What's really happening is that the government has come up with mechanisms to shave a little bit of your income. A dollar here, $10 there, $30 here that you never see. And if you can get the government to adopt a regulation that takes 1 penny a day from every person in America and sweeps it to you, at the end of a year, nobody will notice. Anybody here think they would notice a penny a day that's just sort of subtly drifted away from them? Well, the recipient will have $1.1 billion. And you'll never know. Now, I said I'd come back to this this issue of the people at the top. The top tenth of 1%, that group that starts at $2 million, their total income, one in 1,000 Americans, is almost equal to that of the bottom 50% of Americans. And the share of the pie in this country is changing. A bigger and bigger share is getting to the people at the top, and their share is growing so fast that the share of pie, the absolute amount of pie going to the bottom 90%, is shrinking. When the Great Depression and the Great Recession are examined, you discover something very, very revealing. The Great Depression officially ended in 1932. From 1934, and we're going to compare it with 2012 against the end of the Great Depression in 2009. Well, after the Great Depression ended in the 30s, the oligarchs, the 1% of the 1%, their income went down slightly. And the 90%, their income went up almost 9%. Almost 9%, that's a huge increase in real terms. But in 2012, the income of the bottom 90% of Americans had fallen to 16% below where it was during the recession in 2009. They had less money, even though the economy was expanding. And the 1% of the 1%, their income went up 20% in just 3 years. Government policy is causing this. And while you will hear all the time, oh, the moochers, the 47%, the takers, the reality is that the takers are the people at the very top. Government takes from the many to give to the few. And this is done through rules passed by politicians, most of whom will hold up a Bible. They may hold up just the Old Testament if they're Jews. They may hold up the Quran as well if they're the one member of Congress who's a Muslim, although he's not one of the people who does this. But they will all tell you, you know, I believe in Judeo-Christian principles on which this country was founded. Well, let me tell you one of those principles that's in the Old Testament, because the Old Testament talks about taking from the widow to give to the king. And it has a very simple, straightforward word to describe taking from those with less to give to those with more. Evil. That's what our policies are. And when we have this inequality, it saps people's understanding. It causes people to become fearful. It separates us from our neighbors. It creates insecurity. Wage theft. If you work in the primary labor market, you know, if you have an education and you've worked well, wage theft? What are you talking about? Nobody's ever steals wages. You get paid. Your check comes, and you know, you may not think it's enough, but you get paid what you're supposed to get paid. Millions and millions and millions of Americans get cheated all the time. And what's really outrageous about this is this isn't just people who find casual labor hanging around the Lowe's or the Home Depot to help them with some terrible heavy back-breaking project in the backyard. It's not sleazy little employers. McDonald's has been caught doing this. McDonald's? Company that spends all that money telling you how wonderful they are? Stealing from their workers. We have fewer labor inspectors in America today than we did in 1940. There were only a little over 100 million Americans in 1940, and we had more labor inspectors. The decimation of unions is another part of this. If you believe in market economics, and most of my work in the last 20 years has been in many ways about competitive markets and integrity, if you believe in market economics, then you believe in unions. The Supreme Court has defined what a market is: a buyer and a seller, each in reasonable command of the facts, without any duress, reaching an agreement on a price. And when you take a job, there's a price. You're selling your labor, they're buying your labor. How many of you think an 18-year-old high school kid, freshly minted, going down to the mill looking for work, has any idea what he's actually worth? And you know, in Wisconsin, let's go to college graduates with an extra year to become a teacher. How many of you think kindergarten teachers, 23-year-old wannabe kindergarten teachers, have any idea what they're worth and the value they add to society? By the way, they have a term for kindergarten teachers among Governor Scott Walker's supporters in Wisconsin. They call them thugs. Thugs. Think about that. We've created a society so hell-bent on thinking about the rich, on worshiping the rich, on denigrating people who aren't rich, that we've actually had public demonstrations and attacks on teachers, calling them thugs. And the politician at the head of that movement survived a recall election.
You're listening to David K. Johnston on the societal impact of inequality.
Do you have a car, a boat, or a motorcycle that's really ready to go, kind of like on its last legs? It's probably been really good to you. Well, check out this idea. How about let it do one more good thing and benefit KPFK? Your donation is tax deductible and it's easy to do. For more information about how the donation process works and how to get your tax deduction, all you have to do is call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's it.
This is Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Now, I by no means want to create a society where everybody's equal. My brother is a manual laborer. He's now on disability because he's all busted up. Because of his work, lots of people got to work because somebody was down there in the snowstorm or the rainstorm getting the tree out of the culvert so the water would flow. And he lives in a manufactured home, and he gets by on an extremely modest income, and he drives a car I gave him. Because he chose to spend his life running around, going to baseball games, drinking beer, and chasing girls. He got his just desserts. People who come up with new businesses, smarter, better ideas, better mousetraps, they deserve to make a lot of money. But make it in the marketplace. Don't take it from your and my pockets through government policies. And that's what this is about. It is government policy that is redistributing income. Theodore Roosevelt, a Republican, said this back in the early days of his presidency. The man of great wealth owes a peculiar obligation to the state because he deserves special advantages from the mere existence of government. And what's happening in our society is that the very wealthiest people, because their interest isn't a penny a day, but $1 billion a year, hire very, very smart people to get the government to adopt the rules, which I don't expect you to go spend time learning about these things. That's not your job. That's my job. But to get the government to write rules that quietly, subtly drain your pocket and put money in their pockets. And the elements of doing this are, in the long run, disastrous for us. Because the elements of doing this are essentially to protect existing fortunes against new fortunes. The economist Joseph Schumpeter came up with a great phrase to describe what capitalism does. He called it creative destruction. The internet is creative destruction to newspapers. And the internet is in the early stages of completely remaking our economy. There are other changes that are going to come to our economy. But if we have rules that say we're going to protect the existing wealth holders, we're going to protect the cable companies and the telephone companies against the new competitors, which is what we're doing. We're going to protect the drug companies, and when their patents run out after 17 years, we're going to allow them to pay generic drug makers to not make generic versions of drugs so they can keep charging the price when they had a legal monopoly. We will be poorer in the future. If we decide, as many, many politicians in this country say, if you listen to the news, you will see this again and again, you can go to the internet and look at it. We can't afford to fix our roads. We can't afford to fix bridges. We can't afford to fix dams. American people are too overtaxed. We can't afford this. Well, I hope you enjoy trying to drive to work down the rutted path that's in your future. We can't afford not to. We can't afford to have college educations for young people unless they borrow lots of money because we just can't afford it. Never mind that one of the greatest wealth creators in American history was a program called the GI Bill. I went to college on the GI Bill because technically I'm a war orphan. My dad was a 100% disabled veteran of the war. If I came of age today, if I were 18 years old today, even without a family, I wouldn't be able to go to college in the circumstances I was in. I couldn't do it. And I have interviewed many, many young people who can't even go to junior college because of the tuition. Never mind the opportunity to have the GI Bill that was, in my case, enough to pay for my books. One last little fact I want you to keep in mind, and that is the cost of the American healthcare system, which is one of the most devastating, awful things. Barack Obama adopted the conservative Republican idea that we don't want free riders and everybody should buy insurance, just like everybody has to buy car insurance. If you have a mortgage, everybody has to buy fire insurance on their home. You don't have a mortgage, you want to go uninsured, go right ahead. But your bank's going to let you do it if there's a mortgage. And the Affordable Care Act continues this system we have of health insurance, an industry that I think is totally superfluous, unnecessary. Well, if you look at the spending on healthcare of the 34 modern countries in the world, and you separate the United States over here and you look at the other 33, they all have universal healthcare. Many of them, like France, there's no out-of-pocket costs. I got sick once in France. My wife took me to the doctor. When I got all done being treated, I reached in my back pocket, I pulled out my wallet, and I said, okay, well, who do I go to pay? And the doctor goes, oh, yes, you Americans, you have this strange idea that doctors should also be businessmen and accountants. Here in France, doctors practice medicine. Au revoir. For every dollar that these other countries spent per person for universal care, we spent $2.64. That's an enormous amount of money. That is so much money that it, by on its face, shouldn't tell you that we're uncompetitive with the rest of the world. $2.64. And by the way, the lifespans of people in other countries are growing faster than ours. So we're not buying longer lives and better health care, better health status with our money. It's not what we're getting. Well, how much is that? $1 per person versus $2.64. Well, I'm going to negotiate against myself. I'm going to pick a high-cost country. France is one of the most expensive countries in the world for healthcare. They have universal healthcare, no out-of-pocket costs. You want to get a facelift, you're going to pay for that. You get a scar on your face from an accident, no cost. If we had had the French healthcare system in 2010, we would have spent 11.6% of our economy on healthcare. We actually spent 17.6% of our economy. That's 6 percentage points of gross domestic product above the French, with 50 million Americans that year with no insurance and 30 million with part-year insurance. How much is that? It was enough money to eliminate the income tax. Think about all that money you paid to the Treasury that came out of your paycheck, or you wrote a check for at the end of the year. All else being equal, if we'd had the French healthcare system, everybody would have had healthcare, and we would have had no income tax in 2010. And this year, we'd have an enormous, smaller income tax bill. We could certainly eliminate all income taxes for everybody who makes less than $200,000 a year and have money left over. We are living in a country that has lost sight of the reasons that it's here. And we have lost sight of the purposes of our country, and we have begun to focus on the idea, the absolutely baseless idea, that the purpose of the United States is to make money for people. We actually have the purpose of our country written down for us. It's in the preamble to the Constitution. We, the people of the United States of America, in order to form a more perfect union, language put in by those people who knew they had to swallow slavery in order to get a deal, and promising that someday we will get rid of this, as we did. Establish justice. That's what civilization is. It's justice. If you live in man's natural state, anybody who wants to, who's bigger than you, tougher than you, has a bigger sword than you, they just run you through with it and take whatever you have. Provide for the common defense. Duh. Promote domestic tranquility. Now, that's language about our being able to live in peace on the streets. It was also somewhat the language of the slave-owning states who were worried that they wanted to be sure the government would put down slave rebellions. To promote the general welfare, and in the original, there's a capital W. To promote the general welfare. And to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do hereby ordain this Constitution for the people of the United States of America. Nothing in there talks about getting rich. Nothing in there talks about economic growth, because a country based on the idea that its purpose is to make people rich is a country that cannot survive. That's not a principled reason to have a country. We created this country so the human spirit would flourish. We created this country to show that we could be the captains of our own fate. We would decide, or as Theodore Roosevelt said, in the long run, we shall all rise together or fall together. And I'm going to tell you what I fear if we don't get a handle on inequality. From the experience of the past, from what happened in 18th century France, from what's happened again and again and around the world, if we don't get a handle on inequality, if we don't recognize that it is destroying our health, destroying our democracy, destroying our freedoms, our heirs are going to sit down in high school one of these days, and they are going to open their 10th grade history book, and they're going to read a chapter that begins with the words, "The United States of America was." Thank you.
You've talked about policy prescriptions and a range of policies that, if repealed or changed, would sort of fundamentally alter this inequality issue. Some people have suggested that things have gotten so far out of hand that really, absent a more systemic change or a set of changes, it's unrealistic to think that minor reforms could change things. And just sort of one fact I'll add to that is,
the scale between the operations of industry and politics have changed so much over the past couple hundred years, where things initially were a little out of hand, but now, you know, the size of, let's just say, Boeing's operations versus the size of state legislative offices are so out of whack that one sort of wonders, how easy is it or feasible is it to do this via a policy approach? Thank you.
If you believe in the idea of the United States, then we can solve any problem we have. I teach my students at Syracuse University in one of my two classes that there are at least seven places in the Constitution, without ever mentioning the word slavery, because it never appears till the 13th Amendment, are there to reinforce slavery. No tax on exports and other measures. We got rid of slavery. It cost us 638,000 lives, of which about 40,000 were black Americans, but we got rid of slavery in this country. We haven't got rid of the stain of slavery, but we got rid of slavery. Women got back the right to vote. Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, one a woman who never married and one who had eight children, devoted their whole lives to getting back the right to vote for women. And they succeeded, although Susan B. Anthony died before it happened, and supposedly her last words were, "It is inevitable." We had an effort to get child labor laws in this country more than 100 years ago, and the Jerry Falwells and Pat Robertsons of the day were going around saying, it is God's plan that these children work in these factories, and those who favor these child labor laws, they're the agents of the devil. We got child labor laws. We got unions. And by the way, when we defeated Japan, we imposed a constitution on Japan that requires unions as a basic right. We have environmental laws that, although they're being weakened, are pretty darn good, and they were signed by a Republican president. Although if he came back today, I suspect Richard Nixon would be compared unfavorably with Dennis Kucinich, being further to the left than Dennis. So I believe that we can solve these problems, because if I don't believe it, then I can't believe in the idea of our American experiment. But I don't mean to suggest it's easy. I don't mean to suggest it'll happen tomorrow. But I do think that the age of Reagan, and that's what we're living in, every president since 1981 has been a Reaganista, that we can, in fact, solve these problems, but we can only solve them if we work at them. So, you know, we got to stop watching Dancing with the Stars. We got to get people to vote. You know why Scott Walker wasn't recalled in Wisconsin? Because the unions and the progressives, they all put their money into buying media ads. You know where the Koch brothers put their money? They hired people, apparently including out-of-work people who were desperate for cash, and said, we'll give you some money and fill your gas tank if you drive people to the polls. The 90% must win if they vote. Doesn't matter how much money the people arrayed against them have. If the 90% vote, they're going to win. And don't forget, there are a lot of people at the very top who understand these issues. A lot of my best sources are people who are incredibly wealthy. The ones who don't get it are the financiers. Because if you're in finance, everybody you meet, even the secretaries, are well paid. But if you're in metal bending, you know, you make widgets, you have to deal with the whole labor market. And while where I live in Rochester, a small town where everybody who's very wealthy, I basically know, I've had scotch with them in their backyard. It's a lot better than the scotch you get when you come to my backyard. They may not agree with my solutions, but they all recognize the problems. We can solve this, and we do it by appealing to people's hearts. You know, what did Gandhi say to the British, to their faces? You just think we're going to walk out? Yes, in the end, you will walk out. And in 1947, they did. So we can win. We can change this, but it's not easy. It's going to be a lot of work.
Can you tell us how we got from, not why we got from, but how we got from a time in 1965 when LBJ could declare war on poverty to where we are today, where we have a war on the poor?
Yes.
And what that has to do with inequality?
Well, first of all, we only fought a skirmish on poverty. I've written a number of pieces about Paul Ryan, what I call Paul Ryan math. You know, he's one of these guys who adds up one column of numbers in his checkbook. He puts in all the spending, but he puts in nothing about the income side. Yeah, I think that's very easy to understand. I think that, first of all, it's part of what Adam Smith told us about. I mean, come on, you want to hang out with homeless people? You want to hang out with people at the bottom of the income. I do a lot of time with people like that because I want to know what they think. But I don't go home every night and say, hey, Jennifer, let's get in the car and go talk to a bunch of people getting by on half the average income in Rochester, New York. We have the second highest concentration of extreme poverty in America in Rochester. It's easy to demagogue the poor. And it's easy to also misunderstand what poverty is. There's a very important chapter in this book by Adam Smith called Necessaries. And any of you watch Fox News, or as I like to call it, faux news, and I run Fox News in the background of my office at home all the time, they've been going around saying lately, there are no poor people in America. They have refrigerators. And Adam Smith wrote about the fact that in his time, whether you needed nobody needs a linen shirt, except in England, if you didn't have a linen shirt, nobody would hire you for a job because there must be something wrong with you. He wrote about, in France, it's okay for women to go barefoot all the time. Nobody thinks anything of it. But in England, women are expected to have shoes, and leather shoes at that. These are what he called necessaries. A refrigerator, I think, we can describe as a necessary. A television set is a necessary. A telephone is a necessary in the society we live in, not in his. And so by taking these little examples and appealing to people in vile ways, we can appeal to their worst instincts. And you know, LBJ, too bad that he made these terrible wrong decisions about the war in Vietnam, because otherwise I think he'd go down in history as the greatest president. He really cared about the poor. He didn't appoint racist judges to the federal bench. He didn't tell J. Edgar Hoover, oh yeah, ignore all that bad stuff. And he knew what Hoover had on him. He said, you go after these people who are bombing churches and killing civil rights workers. And he said, we've got to raise the standards of people. He appealed to our better instincts. That's what Gandhi, that's what Christ, that's what Muhammad, that is what Susan B. Anthony, that is what Frederick Douglass, that is what Martin Luther King have all said. They've tried to appeal to our better instincts. And that should work. Right now, we have a leading Republican, Paul Ryan, very likely going to be a candidate for president of the United States, and maybe he'll become president if we don't pay attention, who is the follower of a Russian emigre who's an atheist, who taught that love is selfish and altruism is a vice. Can you imagine what would be going on in this country if Barack Obama had been a follower of Ayn Rand? What people would be saying about, you know, the Kenyan socialist Mau Mau president of the United States if he'd been a follower of hers. And so part of this is this distortion. Part of it is people at the top setting the agenda. Part of it is our wish to emulate these people, the lifestyles of the rich and famous. And we need to focus on appealing to our better natures, to the character of people. But that's how we got that shift, I believe, was a sharp change in values that somehow equated wealth with virtue in a way that even Calvinists should be offended. In one of my books, Free Lunch, I tell a story. I want you to imagine for a moment that somebody comes running in the door here right now and says, have you heard the breaking news? And they bring a radio and it says a comet that we didn't detect is headed towards Earth. And it's the most unusual comet we've ever seen. And we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but they think they're going to be a spectacular light show. And so we all go outside and we go, wow! And it takes this comet's tail, a whole rotation of the Earth, for this to happen. So everybody on the planet sees this thing and they go, that was really cool! And then we go inside and we go to bed, right? 10 years go by, and some of us begin to notice that 1 in 1,000 of us haven't aged. We haven't aged one day since then. We've never gotten sick. And these 1 in 1,000 people, we began to realize over time, have become immortal. And furthermore, their personalities have changed. They are only interested in making money. They don't care about love, family, patriotism, sex. All they care about is money. And they are amoral. Not immoral, not moral. They are amoral. Anything the law says they can do to get money, they'll do. Now, if that happened, we'd have to change all of our laws. Because all of our laws have an unstated assumption that, guess what, you die. God screwed up there. But you're going to die. And here these people are going to live forever. And if they can earn any rate of return higher than everybody else, they will eventually own every single asset they want to earn. They will own everything over time except that which is not worth it to them to earn. You know what I've just described to you? A corporation. It's immortal. You know, it never gets sick. It's amoral. And it's only about making money. And it can die if, just as these people in a car crash, if you're in a plane and you're an immortal, you hit the granite cloud, as the pilots call it, you're dead. The corporation can run out of cash. That's its blood. But we now have zombie corporations. We just put them in bankruptcy. We inject them with new cash. They come back to life. And if it isn't enough money, we give them $83 billion a year like we do to the big banks, which is more than we give to people on food stamps. And we would have to change our laws to recognize this fundamental fact. Well, Chief Justice Rehnquist, who was a real conservative, in a decision called Bilotti versus North Bank of Boston, a dissent, said that we should not give political rights to corporations. And he said the court should pay extreme deference to many, many, many legislators and others who had said giving political rights to corporations is not a good idea. Nothing in the founding documents suggests that corporations should have founding rights. In fact, you know how many corporations there were in America, created in America at the time of the signing of the Declaration of Independence? No, there had been seven. Six of them today, including the Boston Water Works, we would call public utilities or charities. Exactly one of them was created for the purpose of making a profit. It was in the 1620s in what is now Connecticut, and it was such a scandal that within a year they had to shut it down, and it took the state the colonial legislature a decade to clean up the mess. The founders didn't like corporations. They didn't trust corporations. Corporations were vehicles for oppression and abuse. The British East India Company, which led to the Boston Tea Party, got a tax exemption. That's what our country's founded on. It's not a fight against high taxes, it's against a tax exemption. And so what's happened in our time is we've gone from the official court reporter of the Supreme Court in 1888, that's basically the chief clerk of the court, who just happened to be a former president of a railroad, issuing a statement on behalf of the court in a case between Santa Clara and San Mateo counties in California against the Southern Pacific, or as those of us who grew up in California have learned, the octopus, saying they have property rights under the 14th Amendment. But the court isn't going to hear the case. Corporations have property rights. Well, corporations are property. So I think it's not unreasonable to say corporations have property rights. They have a right to defend their existence in issues of property. But political rights? Corporations don't vote.
Do you think that right now we are headed for another bust? And how can we address this wild speculation that happens on Wall Street that puts the world economy at risk?
Okay. Thank you. Well, we've had all sorts of booms and busts. You know, we always change the name when the economy falls apart. You know, there were panics and we had a depression. Now we call it the Great Recession. I don't know what we'll come up with next. The Great Lulu. But government shouldn't be encouraging speculation. The hedge funds you read about, whose managers and owners, people like Mitt Romney, they're not required to pay any taxes. They can defer all their money into the hedge fund and pay no taxes and then just borrow against it to live on. That's why I knew Romney would never release his tax returns, all of them, just a couple of years. They're able to do what they're doing now because we're loaning them all this money. We're letting them borrow enormous sums of money from banks. Officially, they borrow at a 30-to-1 ratio. I've shown in one of my books from court records that one of them was borrowing at a 250-to-1 ratio. Incredibly high speculative risk, and they can bring down the whole economy. And yes, we're going to have another crisis. I don't know when it'll happen, but the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, Congress appointed to investigate the 2008 collapse. And they gave it a budget of just $10 million. And to understand how little that is, in inflation-adjusted terms at the time, the Monica Lewinsky dress investigation cost $100 million. So you want to talk about priorities? Lying husbands in blue dresses outdo the financial collapse of the country 10 to 1. They said in their report that this is going to happen again. I've written columns quoting the chairman of the report and other people saying, this is going to happen again. We're going to have another collapse. And the reason we're going to have that collapse is we've set up a system in which those people who position themselves for collapses, when asset prices fall, buy up assets dirt cheap. I mean, if you had had the cash to go buy the Vanguard 500 index in 2009, today you'd have 2.5 times the amount of money you spent. You'd have done great. The market's gone from like 7,300 to 16,000 under Obama. And so, yes, it's going to happen again. It's going to happen because we allow it to happen, because it's government policy to have it happen, just as it's government policy, congressional policy, to take from the many to give to the few. And we're only going to change that when we change who we elect to office, the awareness of the American people about it, and we insist on rules that promote the general welfare. So let me leave you with one last thought. Whatever you go out and do after you leave here tonight, think about the future of our country. Think about all the wonderful things that have happened to you and the people around you and the struggles that people have made and the people who died, whether they died in Omaha Beach or they died in the Civil War or they died because they were machine gunned by the Rockefellers in their tents while they slept during a strike in Colorado 100 years ago. Think about all the people who sacrificed so you could have what you have today and ask yourself, what are you doing to make sure that people who will never know of you, people who will be born after you die, what are you doing so that they have the same opportunities that you've had? Thank you.
That was David K. Johnston on the societal impact of inequality. He spoke at Town Hall in Seattle at an event organized by the Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's the author of many books, including Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, and Divided. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. Since we began broadcasting in 1986, AR is independent. That's why we can feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Richard Wolff, Sandra Steingraber, Joseph Stiglitz, Paul Ehrlich, Arundhati Roy, Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, Barbara Ehrenreich, and Tariq Ali. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Stephen Bezruchka. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music. Gavin Dahl is AR station liaison. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Engage in any activity
that shall contribute
to a lasting understanding
between nations and between the individuals of all nations,
races, creeds, and colors.
To gather and disseminate information
on the causes of conflict
between any and all of such groups,
and through any and all means
compatible with the purposes of this corporation,
to promote the study of political and economic problems
and of the causes of religious, philosophical,
and racial antagonisms.
That is our mission.
Spotlight Africa speaks to a different African reality.
I think we need to begin to engage as equals rather than begin to engage as if we are Africa is a territory where people from outside have a right to be able to dictate and give a solution.
It's about understanding contemporary Africa, the continent's current affairs, politics, economics, and the significance of Africa globally. I am Assumpta Oturu. Join us every Saturday at noon here on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. That is Spotlight Africa every Saturday at noon here on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. And our countries are
the colonial structures.
Africa for Africa.
Border lines to keep us forever.
You're listening to KPFA 90.7 FM Los Angeles.